Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins think it hard upon the young man if there really is no will, and consider that a handsome present ought to be made him out of the estate. Young Piper and young Perkins, as members of that restless juvenile circle which is the terror of the foot passengers in Chancery Lane, crumble into ashes behind the pump and under the archway all day long, where wild yells and hootings take place over their remains. Little Swills and Miss M. Melvilleson enter into affable conversation with their patrons, feeling that these unusual occurrences level the barriers between professionals and non-professionals. Mr. Bogsby puts up "A Popular Song of King Death, with chorus by the whole strength of the company," as the great harmonic feature of the week, and announces in the bill that J.G.B. is induced to do so at a considerable extra expense, in consequence of a wish which has been very generally expressed at the bar by a large body of respectable individuals, and in homage to a late melancholy event which has aroused so much sensation. There is one point connected with the deceased upon which the court is particularly anxious, namely, that the fiction of a full-sized coffin should be preserved, though there is so little to put in it. Upon the undertaker's stating in the Sol's Bar in the course of the day that he has received orders to construct a 6-footer, the general solicitude is much relieved, and it is considered that Mr. Smallweed's conduct does him great honour. Out of the court, and a long way out of it, there is considerable excitement too, for men of science and philosophy come to look, and carriages set down doctors at the corner who arrive with the same intent, and there is more learned talk about inflammable gases and phosphuretted hydrogen than the court has ever imagined. Some of these authorities, of course the wisest, hold with indignation that the deceased had no business to die in the alleged manner, and being reminded by other authorities of a certain inquiry into the evidence for such deaths, reprinted in the 6th volume of the Philosophical Transactions, and also of a book not quite unknown on English medical jurisprudence, and likewise of the Italian case of the Countess Cornelia Baudi, as set forth in detail by one Bianchini, prebendary of Verona, who wrote a scholarly work or so, and was occasionally heard of in his time as having gleams of reason in him, and also of the testimony of Messrs. Faudéret and Mère, two pestilent Frenchmen who would investigate the subject, and further of the corroborative testimony of Monsieur Le Cap, a rather celebrated French surgeon once upon a time, who had the unpoliteness to live in a house where such a case occurred, and even to write an account of it. Still they regard the late Mr. Crook's obstinacy in going out of the world by any such byway as wholly unjustifiable and personally offensive. The less the court understands of all this, the more the court likes it, and the greater enjoyment it has in the stock-in-trade of the Sol's Arms. Then there comes the artist of a picture newspaper, with a foreground and figures ready drawn for anything from a wreck on the Cornish coast to a review in Hyde Park or a meeting in Manchester, and in Mrs. Perkins' own room, memorable evermore, he then and there throws in upon the block Mr. Crook's house, as large as life, in fact, considerably larger, making a very temple of it. Similarly, being permitted to look in at the door of the fatal chamber, he depicts that apartment as 3/4 of a mile long by 50 yards high, at which the court is particularly charmed. All this time, the two gentlemen before mentioned pop in and out of every house and assist at the philosophical disputations, go everywhere and listen to everybody, and yet are always diving into the Sol's parlour and writing with ravenous little pens on the tissue paper. At last come the coroner and his inquiry, like as before, except that the coroner cherishes this case as being out of the common way, and tells the gentleman of the jury, in his private capacity, that
"That would seem to be an unlucky house next door, gentlemen, a destined house. But so we sometimes find it, and these are mysteries we can't account for."
After which the 6-footer comes into action, and is much admired. In all these proceedings Mr. Guppy has so slight a part, except when he gives his evidence, that he has moved on like a private individual, and can only haunt the secret house on the outside, where he has the mortification of seeing Mr. Smallweed padlocking the door, and of bitterly knowing himself to be shut out. But before these proceedings draw to a close, that is to say, on the night next after the catastrophe, Mr. Guppy has a thing to say that must be said to Lady Dedlock. For which reason, with a sinking heart, and with that hang-dog sense of guilt upon him which dread and watching enfolded in the Sol's Arms have produced, the young man of the name of Guppy presents himself at the town mansion at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and requests to see her ladyship. Mercury replies that she is going out to dinner. Don't he see the carriage at the door? Yes, he does see the carriage at the door, but he wants to see my lady too. Mercury is disposed, as he will presently declare to a fellow gentleman in waiting, to pitch into the young man, but his instructions are positive. Therefore he sulkily supposes that the young man must come up into the library. There he leaves the young man in a large room, not over light, while he makes report of him. Mr. Guppy looks into the shade in all directions, discovering everywhere a certain charred and whitened little heap of coal or wood. Presently he hears a rustling. Is it? No, it's no ghost, but fair flesh and blood, most brilliantly dressed.
I have to beg your ladyship's pardon, Mr. Guppy stammers, very downcast. This is an inconvenient time.
I told you, you could come at any time. She takes a chair, looking straight at him as on the last occasion.
Thank your ladyship. Your ladyship is very affable.
You can sit down. There is not much affability in her tone.
I don't know, your ladyship, that it's worth while my sitting down and detaining you, for I have not got the letters that I mentioned when I had the honour of waiting on your ladyship.
Have you come merely to say so?
Merely to say so, your ladyship.
Mr. Guppy, besides being depressed, disappointed, and uneasy, is put at a further disadvantage by the splendour and beauty of her appearance. She knows its influence perfectly, has studied it too well to miss a grain of its effect on anyone. As she looks at him so steadily and coldly, he not only feels conscious that he has no guide in the least perception of what is really the complexion of her thoughts, but also that he is being every moment, as it were, removed further and further from her. She will not speak, it is plain. So he must.
In short, your ladyship, says Mr. Guppy, like a meanly penitent thief, the person I was to have had the letters of has come to a sudden end, and—
He stops. Lady Dedlock calmly finishes the sentence.
And the letters are destroyed with the person?
Mr. Guppy would say no if he could, as he is unable to hide.
I believe so, your ladyship.
If he could see the least sparkle of relief in her face now. No, he could see no such thing. Even if that brave outside did not utterly put him away, and he were not looking beyond it and about it. He falters an awkward excuse or two for his failure.
Is this all you have to say?
Inquires Lady Dedlock, having heard him out, or as nearly out as he can stumble. Mr. Guppy thinks that's all.
You had better be sure that you wish to say nothing more to me, this being the last time you will have the opportunity.
Mr. Guppy is quite sure, and indeed he has no such wish at present by any means.
That is enough. I will dispense with excuses. Good evening to you.
And she rings for Mercury to show the young man of the name of Guppy out. But in that house, in that same moment, there happens to be an old man of the name of Tulkinghorn, and that old man, coming with his quiet footstep to the library, has his hand at that moment on the handle of the door, comes in, and comes face to face with the young man as he is leaving the room. One glance between the old man and the lady, and for an instant the blind that is always down flies up. Suspicion, eager and sharp, looks out. Another instant, close again.
I beg your pardon, Lady Dedlock. I beg your pardon 1,000 times. It is so very unusual to find you here at this hour. I supposed the room was empty. I beg your pardon.
Stay, she negligently calls him back. Remain here, I beg. I'm going out to dinner. I have nothing more to say to this young man.
The disconcerted young man bows as he goes out, and cringingly hopes that Mr. Tulkinghorn of the Fields is well.
Aye,
says the lawyer, looking at him from under his bent brows, though he has no need to look again, not he.
From Kenge and Carboys, surely.
Kenge and Carboys, Mr. Tulkinghorn. Name of Guppy, sir.
To be sure. Why, thank you, Mr. Guppy. I am very well.
Happy to hear it, sir. You can't be too well, sir, for the credit of the profession.
Thank you, Mr. Guppy.
Mr. Guppy sneaks away. Mr. Tulkinghorn, such a foil in his old-fashioned rusty black to Lady Dedlock's brightness, hands her down the staircase to her carriage. He returns, rubbing his chin.
and rubbed it a good deal in the course of the evening. Chapter 34 A Turn of the Screw.
"Now what," says Mr. George, "may this be? Is it blank cartridge or ball? A flash in the pan or a shot?"
An open letter is the subject of the trooper's speculations, and it seems to perplex him mightily. He looks at it at arm's length, brings it close to him, holds it in his right hand, holds it in his left hand, reads it with his head on this side, with his head on that side, contracts his eyebrows, elevates them, still cannot satisfy himself. He smooths it out upon the table with his heavy palm, and thoughtfully walking up and down the gallery, makes a halt before it every now and then to come upon it with a fresh eye. Even that won't do.
"Is it,"
Mr. George still muses,
"blank cartridge or ball?"
Phil Squad, with the aid of a brush and paint pot, is employed in the distance whitening the targets, softly whistling in quick march time and in drum and fife manner that he must and will go back again to the girl he left behind him.
"Phil!"
the trooper beckons as he calls him. Phil approaches in his usual way, sidling off at first as if he were going anywhere else, and then bearing down upon his commander like a bayonet charge. Certain splashes of white show in high relief upon his dirty face, and he scrapes his one eyebrow with the handle of the brush.
"Attention, Phil! Listen to this!"
"Steady, Commander, steady."
"Sir, allow me to remind you, though there is no legal necessity for my doing so, as you are aware, that the bill at 2 months' date, drawn on yourself by Mr. Matthew Bagnet and by you accepted, for the sum of £97.4.9, will become due tomorrow, when you will please be prepared to take up the same on presentation. Yours, Joshua Smallweed." "What do you make of that, Phil?"
"Mischief, Governor."
"Why?"
"I think," replies Phil, after pensively tracing out a cross wrinkle in his forehead with a brush handle, "that mischievous consequences is always meant when money's asked for."
"Look ye, Phil," says the trooper, sitting on the table, "first and last I have paid, I may say, half as much again as this principal in interest and one thing and another."
Phil intimates by sidling back a pace or two, with a very unaccountable wrench of his wry face, that he does not regard the transaction as being made more promising by this incident.
"And look you further, Phil," says the trooper,
staying his premature conclusions with a wave of his hand.
"There's always been an understanding that this bill was to be what they call renewed, and it has been renewed no end of times. What do you say now?"
"I say that I think the times is come to an end at last."
"You do? I'm much of the same mind myself."
"Joshua Smallweed is him that was brought here in the chair?"
"The same."
"Governor," says Phil with exceeding gravity, "he's a leech in his dispositions. He's a screw and a vice in his actions, a snake in his twistings and a lobster in his claws."
Having thus expressively uttered his sentiments, Mr. Squad, after waiting a little to ascertain if any further remark be expected of him, gets back by his usual series of movements to the target he has in hand, and vigorously signifies through his former musical medium that he must and he will return to that ideal young lady. George, having folded the letter, walks in that direction.
"There is a way, Commander," says Phil, looking cunningly at him, "of settling this."
"But in the money, I suppose? I wish I could."
Phil shakes his head.
"No, Governor, no, not so bad as that. There is a way," says Phil, with a highly artistic turn of his brush. "What I'm a-doing at present."
"Whitewashing?"
Phil nods.
"A pretty way that would be. Do you know what will become of the Bagnets in that case? Do you know they will be ruined to pay off my old scores? You're a moral character," says the trooper, eyeing him in his large way with no small indignation. "Upon my life you are, Phil."
Phil, on one knee at the target, is in course of protesting earnestly, though not without many allegorical scoops of his brush and smoothings of the white surface round the rim with his thumb, that he had forgotten the Bagnet responsibility, and would not so much as injure a hair of the head of any member of that worthy family when steps are audible in the long passage without. And a cheerful voice is heard to wonder whether George is at home. Phil, with a look at his master, hobbles up, saying,
"Here's the Governor, Mrs. Bagnet. Here he is."
And the old girl herself, accompanied by Mr. Bagnet, appears. The old girl never appears in walking trim in any season of the year without a grey cloth cloak, coarse and much worn, but very clean, which is undoubtedly the identical garment rendered so interesting to Mr. Bagnet by having made its way home to Europe from another quarter of the globe in company with Mrs. Bagnet and an umbrella. The latter faithful appendage is also invariably a part of the old girl's presence out of doors. It is of no colour known in this life, and has a corrugated wooden crook for a handle, with a metallic object let into its prow or beak, resembling a little model of a fanlight over a street door, or one of the oval glasses out of a pair of spectacles, which ornamental object has not that tenacious capacity of sticking to its post that might be desired in an article long associated with the British Army. The old girl's umbrella is of a flabby habit of waste, and seems to be in need of stays, an appearance that is possibly referable to its having served through a series of years at home as a cupboard, and on journeys as a carpet-bag. She never puts it up, having the greatest reliance on her well-proved cloak with its capacious hood, but generally uses the instrument as a wand with which to point out joints of meat, or bunches of greens in marketing, or to arrest the attention of tradesmen by a friendly poke. Without her market basket, which is a sort of wicker well with two flapping lids, she never stirs abroad. Attended by these, her trusty companions, therefore, her honest sunburnt face looking cheerily out of a rough straw bonnet, Mrs. Bagnet now arrives, fresh-coloured and bright, in George's shooting gallery.
"Well, George, old fellow," says she, "and how do you do this sunshiny morning?"
Giving him a friendly shake of the hand, Mrs. Bagnet draws a long breath after her walk and sits down to enjoy a rest. Having a faculty, matured on the tops of baggage wagons and in other such positions, of resting easily anywhere, she perches on a rough bench, unties her bonnet strings, pushes back her bonnet, crosses her arms, and looks perfectly comfortable. Mr. Bagnet, in the meantime, has shaken hands with his old comrade and with Phil, on whom Mrs. Bagnet likewise bestows a good-humoured nod and smile.
"Now, George," says Mrs. Bagnet briskly, "here we are, Lignum and myself."
She often speaks of her husband by this appellation, on account, as it is supposed, of Lignum Vitae having been his old regimental nickname when they first became acquainted, in compliment to the extreme hardness and toughness of his physiognomy.
"Just looked in, we have, to make it all correct as usual about that security. Give him the new bill to sign, George, and he'll sign it like a man."
"I was coming to you this morning," observes the trooper reluctantly.
"Yes, we thought you'd come to us this morning. But we turned out early and left Woolwich, the best of boys, to mind his sisters and come to you instead, as you see. For Lignum, he's tied so close now and gets so little exercise that a walk does him good. But what's the matter, George?"
asks Mrs. Bagnet, stopping in her cheerful talk.
"You don't look yourself."
"I'm not quite myself," returns the trooper. "I have been a little put out, Mrs. Bagnet."
Her bright, quick eye catches the truth directly.
"George," holding up her forefinger, "don't tell me there's anything wrong about that security of Lignum's. Don't do it, George, on account of the children."
The trooper looks at her with a troubled visage.
"George,"
says Mrs. Bagnet, using both her arms for emphasis, and occasionally bringing down her open hands upon her knees,
"if you have allowed anything wrong to come to that security of Lignum's, and if you have let him in for it, and if you have put us in danger of being sold up, and I see sold up in your face, George, as plain as print, you have done a shameful action and have deceived us cruelly, I tell you, cruelly, George. There!"
Mr. Bagnet, otherwise as immovable as a pump or a lamp-post, puts his large right hand on the top of his bald head as if to defend it from a shower-bath, and looks with great uneasiness at Mrs. Bagnet.
"George," says that old girl, "I wonder at you. George, I'm ashamed of you. George, I couldn't have believed you would have done it. I always knew you to be a rolling stone that gathered no moss, but I never thought you would have taken away what little moss there was for Bagnet and the children to lie upon. You know what a hard-working, steady-going chap he is. You know what Quebec and Malta and Woolwich are, and I never did think you would or could have had the heart to serve us so. Oh, George!"
Mrs. Bagnet gathers up her cloak to wipe her eyes on in a very genuine manner.
"How could you do it?"
Mrs. Bagnet, ceasing, Mr. Bagnet removes his hand from his head as if the shower-bath were over, and looks disconsolately at Mr. George, who has turned quite white, and looks distressfully at the grey cloak and straw bonnet.
"Mad,"
says the trooper in a subdued voice, addressing him but still looking at his wife.
I'm sorry you take it so much to heart, because I do hope it's not so bad as that comes to. I certainly have, this morning, received this letter,
which he reads aloud,
but I hope it may be set right yet. As to a rolling stone, why, what you say is true. I am a rolling stone, and I never rolled in anybody's way. I fully believe that I rolled the least good to. But it's impossible for an old vagabond comrade to like your wife and family better than I like them, Matt, and I trust you'll look upon me as forgivingly as you can. Don't think I've kept anything from you. I haven't had the letter more than a quarter of an hour.
Old girl, murmurs Mr. Bagnet after a short silence, will you tell him my opinion?
Oh, why didn't he marry?
Mrs. Bagnet answers, half laughing and half crying.
Joe Pouch's widow in North America. Then he wouldn't have got himself into these troubles.
The old girl, says Mr. Bagnet, puts it correct. Why didn't you?
Well, she has a better husband by this time, I hope,
returns the trooper.
Anyhow, here I stand this present day not married to Joe Pouch's widow. What should I do? You see all I've got about me. It's not mine, it's yours. Give the word and I'll sell off every morsel. If I could have hoped it would have brought in nearly the sum wanted, I'd have sold all long ago. Don't believe that I'll leave you or yours in the lurch, Matt. I'd sell myself first. I only wish,
says the trooper, giving himself a disparaging blow in the chest,
that I knew of anyone who'd buy such a second-hand piece of old stores.
Old girl, murmurs Mr. Bagnet, give him another bit of my mind.
George, says the old girl, you are not so much to be blamed on full consideration, except for ever taking this business without the means.
And that was like me,
observed the penitent trooper, shaking his head.
Like me, I know.
Silence. The old girl, says Mr. Bagnet, is correct in her way of giving my opinions. Hear me out.
That was when you never ought to have asked for the security, George, and when you never ought to have got it, all things considered. But what's done can't be undone. You are always an honourable and straightforward fellow as far as lays in your power, though a little flighty. On the other hand, you can't admit but what it's natural in us to be anxious with such a thing hanging over our heads. So forget and forgive all round, George. Come, forget and forgive all round.
Mrs. Bagnet, giving him one of her honest hands and giving her husband the other, Mr. George gives each of them one of his and holds them while he speaks.
I do assure you both, there's nothing I wouldn't do to discharge this obligation. But whatever I've been able to scrape together has gone every 2 months in keeping it up. We've lived plainly enough here, Phil and I, but the gallery don't quite do what was expected of it, and it's not, in short, it's not the mint. It was wrong in me to take it? Well, so it was. But I was in a manner drawn into that step, and I thought it might steady me and set me up, and you'll try to overlook my having such expectations, and upon my soul I'm very much obliged to you and very much ashamed of myself.
With these concluding words, Mr. George gives a shake to each of the hands he holds, and relinquishing them, backs a pace or two in a broad-chested, upright attitude, as if he had made a final confession and were immediately going to be shot with all military honours.
"George, hear me out," says Mr. Bagnet, glancing at his wife. "Old girl, go on."
Mr. Bagnet, being in this singular manner heard out, has merely to observe that the letter must be attended to without any delay, that it is advisable that George and he should immediately wait on Mr. Smallweed in person, and that the primary object is to save and hold harmless Mr. Bagnet, who had none of the money. Mr. George, entirely assenting, puts on his hat and prepares to march with Mr. Bagnet to the enemy's camp.
"Don't you mind a woman's hasty word, George," says Mrs. Bagnet, patting him on the shoulder. "I trust my old lignum to you, and I'm sure you'll bring him through it."
The trooper returns that this is kindly said, and that he will bring Lignum through it somehow, upon which Mrs. Bagnet, with her cloak, basket, and umbrella, goes home, bright-eyed again to the rest of her family, and the comrades sally forth on the hopeful errand of mollifying Mr. Smallweed. Whether there are two people in England less likely to come satisfactorily out of any negotiation with Mr. Smallweed than Mr. George and Mr. Matthew Bagnet may be very reasonably questioned. Also, notwithstanding their martial appearance, broad square shoulders and heavy tread, whether there are within the same limit two more simple and unaccustomed children in all the small weedy affairs of life. As they proceed with great gravity through the streets towards the region of Mount Pleasant, Mr. Bagnet, observing his companion to be thoughtful, considers it a friendly part to refer to Mrs. Bagnet's late Sally.
"George, you know the old girl. She's as sweet and as mild as milk. But touch her on the children, or myself, and she's off like gunpowder."
"It does her credit, Matt."
"George,"
says Mr. Bagnet, looking straight before him,
"the old girl can't do anything that don't do her credit, more or less. I never say so. Discipline must be maintained."
"She's worth her weight in gold,"
says the trooper.
"In gold," says Mr. Bagnet. "I'll tell you what, the old girl's weight is 12 stone 6. Would I take that weight in any metal for the old girl? No. Why not? Because the old girl's metal is far more precious than the preciousest metal, and she's all metal."
"You are right, Matt."
"When she took me, and accepted of the ring, she listed under me and the children, heart and head, for life. She's that earnest," says Mr. Bagnet, "and true to her colours, that touch us with a finger, and she turns out and stands to her arms. If the old girl fires wide, once in a way, at the call of duty, look over it, George, for she's loyal."
"Why, bless her, Matt,"
returns the trooper.
"I think the higher of her for it."
"You are right,"
says Mr. Bagnet, with the warmest enthusiasm, though without relaxing the rigidity of a single muscle.
"Think as high of the old girl as the Rock of Gibraltar, and still you'll be thinking low of such merits. But I never owned to it before her. Discipline must be maintained."
These encomiums bring them to Mount Pleasant and to Grandfather Smallweed's house. The door is opened by the perennial Judy, who, having surveyed them from top to toe with no particular favour, but indeed with a malignant sneer, leaves them standing there while she consults the oracle as to their admission. The oracle may be inferred to give consent, from the circumstance of her returning with the words on her honey lips, that they can come in if they want to it. Thus privileged, they come in, and find Mr. Smallweed with his feet in the drawer of his chair as if it were a paper footbath, and Mrs. Smallweed obscured with a cushion like a bird that is not to sing.
"My dear friend," says Grandfather Smallweed, with those two lean, affectionate arms of his stretched forth, "howdy do, howdy do. Who is our friend, my dear friend?"
"Well, this,"
returns George, not able to be very conciliatory at first,
"is Matthew Bagnet, who has obliged me in that matter of ours, you know."
"Oh, Mr. Bagnet, surely."
The old man looks at him under his hand.
"Hope you're well, Mr. Bagnet. Fine man, Mr. George. Military air, sir."
No chairs being offered, Mr. George brings one forward for Bagnet and one for himself. They sit down, Mr. Bagnet, as if he had no power of bending himself except at the hips for that purpose.
"Judy," says Mr. Smallweed, "bring the pipe."
"Well, I don't know,"
Mr. George interposes,
"that the young woman need give herself that trouble. For to tell you the truth, I'm not inclined to smoke it today."
"Ain't you?" returns the old man. "Judy, bring the pipe."
"The fact is, Mr. Smallweed,"
proceeds George,
"that I find myself in rather an unpleasant state of mind. It appears to me, sir, that your friend in the city has been playing tricks."
"Oh, dear, no," says Grandfather Smallweed. "He never does that."
"Don't he? Well, I'm glad to hear it, because I thought it might be his doing. This, you know, I'm speaking of. This letter."
And Grandfather Smallweed smiles in a very ugly way in recognition of the letter.
"What does it mean?"
asks Mr. George.
"Judy," says the old man, "have you got the pipe? Give it to me. Did you say what does it mean, my good friend?"
"Aye, now come, come, you know, Mr. Smallweed,"
urges the trooper, constraining himself to speak as smoothly and confidentially as he can, holding the open letter in one hand and resting the broad knuckles of the other on his thigh.
"A good lot of money has passed between us, and we're face to face at the present moment, and are both well aware of the understanding there has always been. I am prepared to do the usual thing which I have done regularly, and to keep this matter going. I never got a letter like this from you before, and I've been a little put about by it this morning, because here's my friend Matthew Bagnet, who, you know, had none of the money."
"I don't know it, you know,"
says the old man quietly.
"Why, confound you, I tell you so, don't I?"
"Oh, yes, you tell me so," returns Grandfather Smallweed, "but I don't know it."
"Well,"
says the trooper, swallowing his fire,
"I know it."
Mr. Smallweed replies with excellent temper,
"Ah, that's quite another thing,"
and adds,
But it don't matter. Mr. Bagnet's situation is all one, whether or no.
The unfortunate George makes a great effort to arrange the affair comfortably, and to propitiate Mr. Smallweed by taking him upon his own terms.
That's just what I mean. As you say, Mr. Smallweed, here's Matthew Bagnet liable to be fixed, whether or no. Now, you see, that makes his good lady very uneasy in her mind, and me too. For whereas I'm a harum-scarum sort of a good-for-naught that more kicks than halfpence come natural to, why, he's a steady family man, don't you see? Now, Mr. Smallweed,
says the trooper, gaining confidence as he proceeds in his soldierly mode of doing business.
Although you and I are good friends enough in a certain sort of a way, I'm well aware that I can't ask you to let my friend Bagnet off entirely.
Oh, dear, you are too modest. You can ask me anything, Mr. George.
There is an ogreish kind of jocularity in Grandfather Smallweed today.
And you can refuse, you mean, eh? Well, not you so much, perhaps, as your friend in the city. Ha, ha, ha!
Ha, ha, ha!
Echoes Grandfather Smallweed, in such a very hard manner, and with eyes so particularly green that Mr. Bagnet's natural gravity is much deepened by the contemplation of that venerable man.
Come, says the sanguine George. I'm glad to find we can be pleasant, because I want to arrange this pleasantly. Here's my friend Bagnet, and here am I. We'll settle the matter on the spot, if you please, Mr. Smallweed, in the usual way. And you'll ease my friend Bagnet's mind and his family's mind a good deal, if you'll just mention to him what our understanding is.
Here some shrill spectre cries out in a mocking manner.
Oh, good gracious, oh!
Unless indeed it be the sportive Judy, who is found to be silent when the startled visitors look round, but whose chin has received a recent toss, expressive of derision and contempt. Mr. Bagnet's gravity becomes yet more profound.
But I think you asked me, Mr. George,
old Smallweed, who all this time has had the pipe in his hand, is the speaker now.
I think you asked me, what did the letter mean?
Why, yes, I did,
returns the trooper in his off-hand way.
But I don't care to know particularly if it's all correct and pleasant.
Mr. Smallweed, purposely balking himself in an aim at the trooper's head, throws the pipe on the ground and breaks it to pieces.
That's what it means, my dear friend. I'll smash you. I'll crumble you. I'll powder you. Go to the devil.
The two friends rise and look at one another. Mr. Bagnet's gravity has now attained its profoundest point.
Go to the devil, repeats the old man. I'll have no more of your pipe smokings and swaggerings. What, you're an independent dragoon, too. Go to my lawyer. You remember where you've been there before, and show your independence now, will you? Come, my dear friend, there's a chance for you. Open the street door, Judy. Put these blusterers out. Call in help if they don't go. Put 'em out.
He vociferates this so loudly that Mr. Bagnet, laying his hands on his shoulders of his comrade before the latter can recover from his amazement, gets him on the outside of the street door, which is instantly slammed by the triumphant Judy. Utterly confounded, Mr. George a while stands looking at the knocker. Mr. Bagnet, in a perfect abyss of gravity, walks up and down before the little parlour window like a sentry, and looks in every time he passes, apparently revolving something in his mind.
"Come, Matt,"
says Mr. George, when he has recovered himself.
"We must try the lawyer. Now what do you think of this rascal?"
Mr. Bagnet, stopping to take a farewell look into the parlour, replies with one shake of his head directed at the interior,
"If my old girl had been here, I'd have told him."
Having so discharged himself on the subject of his cogitations, he falls into step and marches off with the trooper, shoulder to shoulder. When they present themselves in Lincoln's Inn Fields, Mr. Tulkinghorn is engaged and not to be seen. He is not at all willing to see them, for when they have waited a full hour, and the clerk, on his bell being rung, takes the opportunity of mentioning as much, he brings forth no more encouraging message than that Mr. Tulkinghorn has nothing to say to them, and they had better not wait. They do wait, however, with the perseverance of military tactics, and at last the bell rings again, and the client in possession comes out of Mr. Tulkinghorn's room. The client is a handsome old lady, no other than Mrs. Rouncewell, housekeeper at Chesney Wold. She comes out of the sanctuary with a fair, old-fashioned curtsy and softly shuts the door. She is treated with some distinction there, for the clerk steps out of his pew to show her through the outer office and to let her out. The old lady is thanking him for his attention when she observes the comrades in waiting.
"I beg your pardon, sir, but I think those gentlemen are military."
The clerk, referring the question to them with his eye, and Mr. George not turning round from the almanac over the fireplace, Mr. Bagnet takes upon himself to reply,
"Yes, ma'am, formally."
"I thought so. I was sure of it. My heart warms, gentlemen, at the sight of you. It always does at the sight of such. God bless you, gentlemen. You'll excuse an old woman, but I had a son once who went for a soldier. A fine, handsome youth he was, and good in his bold way, though some people did disparage him to his poor mother. I ask your pardon for troubling you, sir. God bless you, gentlemen."
"Same to you, ma'am,"
returns Mr. Bagnet, with a right good will. There is something very touching in the earnestness of the old lady's voice, and in the tremble that goes through her quaint old figure. But Mr. George is so occupied with the almanac over the fireplace, calculating the coming months by it, perhaps, that he does not look round until she has gone away, and the door is closed upon her.
"George,"
Mr. Bagnet gruffly whispers when he does turn from the almanac at last,
"don't be cast down. Why, soldiers, why, should we be melancholy, boys? Cheer up, my hearty."
The clerk, having now again gone in to say that they are still there, and Mr. Tulkinghorn being heard to return with some irascibility, "Let 'em come in, then," they pass into the great room with a painted ceiling, and find him standing before the fire.
"Now, you men, what do you want? Sergeant, I told you the last time I saw you that I don't desire your company here."
Sergeant replies, dashed within the last few minutes as to his usual manner of speech, and even as to his usual carriage, that he has received this letter, has been to Mr. Smallweed about it, and has been referred there.
"I have nothing to say to you," rejoins Mr. Tulkinghorn. "If you get into debt, you must pay your debts or take the consequences. You have no occasion to come here to learn that, I suppose."
Sergeant is sorry to say that he is not prepared with the money.
"Very well. Then the other man, this man, if this is he, must pay it for you."
Sergeant is sorry to add that the other man is not prepared with the money either.
"Very well. Then you must pay it between you, or you must both be sued for it, and both suffer. You have had the money, and must refund it. You are not to pocket other people's pounds, shillings, and pence, and escape scot-free."
The lawyer sits down in his easy chair and stirs the fire. Mr. George hopes he will have the goodness to—
"I tell you, Sergeant, I have nothing to say to you. I don't like your associates, and don't want you here. This matter is not at all in my course of practice, and is not in my office. Mr. Smallweed is good enough to offer these affairs to me, but they are not in my way. You must go to Melchizedek's, in Clifford's Inn."
"I must make an apology to you, sir," says Mr. George, "for pressing myself upon you with so little encouragement, which is almost as unpleasant to me as it can be to you. But would you let me say a private word to you?"
Mr. Tulkinghorn rises with his hands in his pockets and walks into one of the window recesses.
"Now, I have no time to waste."
In the midst of his perfect assumption of indifference, he directs a sharp look at the trooper, taking care to stand with his own back to the light and to have the other with his face towards it.
"Well, sir," says Mr. George, "this man with me is the other party implicated in this unfortunate affair, nominally, only nominally, and my sole object is to prevent his getting into trouble on my account. He is a most respectable man with a wife and family, formerly in the Royal Artillery."
"My friend, I don't care a pinch of snuff for the whole Royal Artillery establishment. Officers, men, tumbrils, wagons, horses, guns, and ammunition."
"'Tis likely, sir. But I care a good deal for Bagnet and his wife and family being injured on my account. And if I could bring them through this matter, I should have no help for it but to give up without any other consideration what you wanted of me the other day."
"Have you got it here?"
"I have got it here, sir."
"Sergeant,"
the lawyer proceeds in his dry, passionless manner, far more hopeless in the dealing with than any amount of vehemence,
"make up your mind while I speak to you, for this is final. After I have finished speaking, I have closed the subject, and I won't reopen it. Understand that? You can leave here, for a few days, what you say you have brought here, if you choose. You can take it away at once, if you choose. In case you choose to leave it here, I can do this for you. I can replace this matter on its old footing, and I can go so far besides as to give you a written undertaking that this man Bagnet shall never be troubled in any way until you have been proceeded against to the utmost, that your means shall be exhausted before the creditor looks to his. This is, in fact, all but freeing him. Have you decided?"
The trooper puts his hand into his breast and answers with a long breath,
"I must do it, sir."
So Mr. Tulkinghorn, putting on his spectacles, sits down and writes the undertaking, which he slowly reads and explains to Bagnet, who has all this time been staring at the ceiling, and who puts his hand on his bald head again under this new verbal shower-bath, and seems exceedingly in need of the old girl through whom to express his sentiments. The trooper then takes from his breast pocket a folded paper, which he lays with an unwilling hand at the lawyer's elbow.
"'Tis only a letter of instruction, sir. The last I ever had from him.
Look at a millstone, Mr. George, for some change in its expression, and you will find it quite as soon as in the face of Mr. Tulkinghorn when he opens and reads the letter. He refolds it, and lays it in his desk, with a countenance as imperturbable as death. Nor has he anything more to say or do, but not once, in the same frigid and discourteous manner, and to say briefly, "You can go. Show these men out there." Being shown out, they repair to Mr. Bagnet's residence to dine. Boiled beef and greens constitute the day's variety on the former repast of boiled pork and greens, and Mrs. Bagnet serves out the meal in the same way, and seasons it with the best of temper, being that rare sort of old girl that she receives good to her arms without a hint that it might be better, and catches light from any little spot of darkness near her. The spot on this occasion is the darkened brow of Mr. George. He is unusually thoughtful and depressed. At first, Mrs. Bagnet trusts to the combined endearments of Quebec and Malta to restore him, but finding those young ladies sensible that their existing Bluffy is not the Bluffy of their usual frolicsome acquaintance, she winks off the light infantry and leaves him to deploy at leisure on the open ground of the domestic hearth. But he does not. He remains in close order, clouded and depressed. During the lengthy cleaning up and patterning process, when he and Mr. Bagnet are supplied with their pipes, he is no better than he was at dinner. He forgets to smoke, looks at the fire and ponders, lets his pipe out, fills the breast of Mr. Bagnet with perturbation and dismay by showing that he has no enjoyment of tobacco. Therefore, when Mrs. Bagnet at last appears, rosy from the invigorating pail, and sits down to her work, Mr. Bagnet growls,
"Old girl,"
and winks monitions to her to find out what's the matter.
"Why, George," says Mrs. Bagnet, quietly threading her needle, "how low you are."
"Am I? Not good company? Well, I'm afraid I'm not."
"He ain't at all like Bluffy, mother," cries little Malta. "Because he ain't well, I think, mother," adds Quebec.
"Sure, that's a bad sign not to be like Bluffy, too," returns the trooper, kissing the young damsels. "But it's true,"
with a sigh.
"True, I'm afraid. These little ones are always right."
"George," says Mrs. Bagnet, working busily, "if I thought you cross enough to think of anything that a shrill old soldier's wife, who could have bitten her tongue off afterwards and ought to have done it almost, said this morning, I don't know what I shouldn't say to you now."
"My kind soul of a darling," returns the trooper, "not a morsel of it."
"Because really and truly, George, what I said and meant to say was that I trusted Lignum to you and was sure you'd bring him through it. And you have brought him through it, Noble."
"Thank you, my dear,"
says George.
"I'm glad of your good opinion."
In giving Mrs. Bagnet's hand, with her work in it, a friendly shake, for she took her seat beside him, the trooper's attention is attracted to her face. After looking at it for a little while as she plies her needle, he looks to young Woolwich, sitting on his stool in the corner, and beckons that fifer to him.
"See there, my boy,"
says George, very gently smoothing the mother's hair with his hand.
"There's a good loving forehead for you, all bright with love of you, my boy. A little touched by the sun and the weather through following your father about and taking care of you, but as fresh and wholesome as a ripe apple on a tree."
Mr. Bagnet's face expresses, so far as in its wooden material lies, the highest approbation and acquiescence.
"The time will come, my boy," pursues the trooper, "when this hair of your mother's will be grey, and this forehead all crossed and recrossed with wrinkles, and a fine old lady she'll be then. Take care, while you are young, that you can think in those days, 'I never whitened a hair of her dear head. I never marked a sorrowful line in her face.' For of all the many things that you can think of when you are a man, you had better have that by you, Woolwich."
Mr. George concludes by rising from his chair, seating the boy beside his mother in it, and saying, with something of a hurry about him, that he'll smoke his pipe in the street a bit. Chapter 35. Esther's Narrative. I lay ill through several weeks, and the usual tenor of my life became like an old remembrance. But this was not the effect of time so much as of the change in all my habits made by the helplessness and inaction of a sick room. Before I had been confined to it many days, everything else seemed to have retired into a remote distance, where there was little or no separation between the various stages of my life which had been really divided by years. In falling ill, I seemed to have crossed a dark lake, and to have left all my experiences, mingled together by the great distance, on the healthy shore. My housekeeping duties, though at first it caused me great anxiety to think that they were unperformed, were soon as far off as the oldest of the old duties at Greenleaf, or the summer afternoons when I went home from school with my portfolio under my arm and my childish shadow at my side to my godmother's house. I had never known before how short life really was, and into how small a space the mind could put it. While I was very ill, the way in which these divisions of time became confused with one another distressed my mind exceedingly. At once a child, an elder girl, and the little woman I had been so happy as, I was not only oppressed by cares and difficulties adapted to each station, but by the great perplexity of endlessly trying to reconcile them. I suppose that few who have not been in such a condition can quite understand what I mean, or what painful unrest arose from this source. For the same reason, I am almost afraid to hint at that time in my disorder. It seemed one long night, but I believe there were both nights and days in it, when I laboured up colossal staircases, ever striving to reach the top, and ever turned, as I have seen a worm in a garden path, by some obstruction, and labouring again. I knew perfectly at intervals, and I think vaguely at most times, that I was in my bed, and I talked with Charlie and felt her touch, and knew her very well, yet I would find myself complaining, "Oh, more of these never-ending stairs, Charlie! More and more, piled up to the sky, I think!" and labouring on again. Dare I hint at that worst time when, strung together somewhere in the great black space, there was a flaming necklace, or ring, or starry circle of some kind, of which I was one of the beads. And when my only prayer was to be taken off from the rest, and when it was such inexplicable agony and misery to be a part of the dreadful thing. Perhaps the less I say of these sick experiences, the less tedious and the more intelligible I shall be. I do not recall them to make others unhappy, or because I am now the least unhappy in remembering them. It may be that if we knew more of such strange afflictions, we might be the better able to alleviate their intensity. The repose that succeeded, the long delicious sleep, the blissful rest when in my weakness I was too calm to have any care for myself, and could have heard, or so I think now, that I was dying with no other emotion than with a pitying love for those I left behind, this state can be perhaps more widely understood. I was in this state when I first shrunk from the light as it twinkled on me once more, and knew with a boundless joy for which no words are rapturous enough that I should see again. I had heard my Ada crying at the door day and night. I had heard her calling to me that I was cruel and did not love her. I had heard her praying and imploring to be let in to nurse and comfort me and to leave my bedside no more. But I had only said, when I could speak, "Never, my sweet girl, never." And I had over and over again reminded Charlie that she was to keep my darling from the room whether I lived or died. Charlie had been true to me in that time of need, and with her little hand and her great heart had kept the door fast. But now, my sight strengthening and the glorious light coming every day more fully and brightly on me, I could read the letters that my dear wrote to me every morning and evening, and could put them to my lips and lay my cheek upon them with no fear of hurting her. I could see my little maid, so tender and so careful, going about the two rooms, setting everything in order, and speaking cheerfully to Ada from the open window again. I could understand the stillness in the house, and the thoughtfulness it expressed on the part of all those who had always been so good to me. I could weep in the exquisite felicity of my heart, and be as happy in my weakness as ever I had been in my strength. By and by my strength began to be restored. Instead of lying with so strange a calmness, watching what was done for me, as if it were done for someone else whom I was quietly sorry for, I helped it a little, and so on to a little more, and much more, until I became useful to myself, and interested, and attached to life again. How well I remember the pleasant afternoon when I was raised in bed with pillows for the first time to enjoy a great tea-drinking with Charlie. The little creature, sent into the world surely to minister to the weak and sick, was so happy and so busy, and stopped so often in her preparations to lay her head upon my bosom and fondle me, and cry with joyful tears, she was so glad, she was so glad, that I was obliged to say, "Charlie, if you go on in this way, I must lie down again, my darling, for I am weaker than I thought I was." So Charlie became as quiet as a mouse, and took her bright face here and there across and across the two rooms, out of the shade into the divine sunshine, and out of the sunshine into the shade, while I watched her peacefully. When all her preparations were concluded, and the pretty tea-table with its little delicacies to tempt me, and its white cloth and its flowers, and everything so lovingly and beautifully arranged for me by Ada downstairs, was ready at the bedside, I felt sure I was steady enough to say something to Charlie that was not new to my thoughts. First I complimented Charlie on the room, and indeed it was so fresh and airy, so spotless and neat, that I could scarce believe I had been lying there so long. This delighted Charlie, and her face was brighter than before. "Yet, Charlie," said I, looking round, "I miss something, surely, that I am accustomed to." Poor little Charlie looked round too, and pretended to shake her head as if there were nothing absent. "Are the pictures all as they used to be?" I asked her. "Every one of them, miss," said Charlie. "And the furniture, Charlie?" "Except where I've moved it about to make more room, miss." "And yet," said I miss some familiar object." "Ah, I know what it is, Charlie. It's the looking-glass." Charlie got up from the table, making as if she had forgotten something, and went into the next room, and I heard her sob there. I had thought of this very often. I was now certain of it. I could thank God that it was not a shock to me now. I called Charlie back, and when she came, at first pretending to smile, but as she drew nearer to me, looking grieved, I took her in my arms and said, "It matters very little, Charlie. I hope I can do without my old face very well." I was presently so far advanced as to be able to sit up in a great chair, and even giddily to walk into the adjoining room, leaning on Charlie. The mirror was gone from its usual place in that room, too, but what I had to bear was none the harder to bear for that. My guardian had throughout been earnest to visit me, and there was now no good reason why I should deny myself that happiness. He came one morning, and when he first came in could only hold me in his embrace and say, "My dear, dear girl." I had long known, who could know better, what a deep fountain of affection and generosity his heart was, and was it not worth my trivial suffering and change to fill such a place in it? "Oh yes," I thought, "he has seen me, and he loves me better than he did. He has seen me, and is even fonder of me than he was before, and what have I to mourn for?" He sat down by me on the sofa, supporting me with his arm. For a little while he sat with his hand over his face, but when he removed it, fell into his usual manner. There never can have been, there never can be, a pleasanter manner. "My little woman," said he, "what a sad time this has been! Such an inflexible little woman, too, through all." "Only for the best, guardian," said I. "For the best?" he repeated tenderly. "Of course, for the best. But here have Ada and I been perfectly forlorn and miserable. Here has your friend Caddy been coming and going, late and early. Here has everyone about the house been utterly lost and dejected. Here has even poor Rick been writing, to me, too, in his anxiety for you." I had read of Caddy in Ada's letters, but not of Richard. I told him so. "Why, no, my dear," he replied. "I have thought it better not to mention it to her." "And you speak of his writing to you," said I, repeating his emphasis, "as if it were not natural for him to do so, guardian, as if he could write to a better friend."
"He thinks he could, my love," returned my guardian, "and to many a better. The truth is, he wrote to me under a sort of protest, while unable to write to you with any hope of an answer. Wrote coldly, haughtily, distantly, resentfully. Well, dearest little woman, we must look forbearingly on it. He is not to blame. Jarndyce and Jarndyce has warped him out of himself and perverted me in his eyes. I have known it do as bad deeds and worse many a time. If two angels could be concerned in it, I believe it would change their nature."
"It has not changed yours, guardian."
"Oh, yes, it has, my dear," he said laughingly. "It has made the south wind easterly, I don't know how often. Rick mistrusts and suspects me, goes to lawyers and is taught to mistrust and suspect me. Hears I have conflicting interests, claims clashing against his and what not. Whereas heaven knows that if I could get out of the mountains of wigglomeration on which my unfortunate name has been so long bestowed, which I can't, or could level them by the extinction of my own original right, which I can't either, and no human power ever can, anyhow, I believe, to such a pass have we got, I would do it this hour. I would rather restore to poor Rick his proper nature than be endowed with all the money that dead suitors, broken heart and soul upon the wheel of Chancery, have left unclaimed with the Accountant General. And that's money enough, my dear, to be cast into a pyramid in memory of Chancery's transcendent wickedness.
"Is it possible, Guardian?" I asked, amazed, "that Richard can be suspicious of you?"
"Ah, my love, my love," he said. "It is in the subtle poison of such abuses to breed such diseases. His blood is infected, and objects lose their natural aspects in his sight. It is not his fault."
"But it is a terrible misfortune, Guardian."
"It is a terrible misfortune, little woman, to be ever drawn within the influences of Jarndyce and Jarndyce. I know none greater. By little and little he has been induced to trust in that rotten reed, and it communicates some portion of its rottenness to everything around him. But again I say with all my soul, we must be patient with poor Rick, and not blame him. What a troop of fine fresh hearts like his have I seen in my time turned by the same means!"
I could not help expressing something of my wonder and regret that his benevolent, disinterested intentions had prospered so little.
"We must not say so, Dame Durden," he cheerfully replied. "Ada is the happier, I hope, and that is much. I did think that I and both these young creatures might be friends instead of distrustful foes, and that we might so far counteract the suit and prove too strong for it. But it was too much to expect. Jarndyce and Jarndyce was the curtain of Rick's cradle."
"But, Guardian, may we not hope that a little experience will teach him what a false and wretched thing it is?"
"We will hope so, my Esther," said Mr. Jarndyce, "and that it may not teach him so too late. In any case, we must not be hard on him. There are not many grown and matured men living while we speak, good men too, who, if they were thrown into this same court as suitors, would not be vitally changed and depreciated within 3 years, within two, within one. How can we stand amazed at poor Rick, a young man so unfortunate?" Here he fell into a lower tone, as if he were thinking aloud. "Cannot at first believe, who could, that Chancery is what it is. He looks to it, flushed and fitfully, to do something with his interests and bring them to some settlement. It procrastinates, disappoints, tries, tortures him, wears out his sanguine hopes and patience, thread by thread. But he still looks to it, and hankers after it, and finds his whole world treacherous and hollow. Well, well, well. Enough of this, my dear."
He had supported me, as at first, all this time, and his tenderness was so precious to me that I leaned my head upon his shoulder and loved him as if he had been my father. I resolved in my own mind in this little pause, by some means, to see Richard when I grew strong and try to set him right.
"There are better subjects than these," said my guardian, "for such a joyful time as the time of our dear girl's recovery, and I had a commission to broach one of them as soon as I should begin to talk. When shall Ada come to see you, my love?"
I had been thinking of that too, a little in connection with the absent mirrors, but not much, for I knew my loving girl would be changed by no change in my looks.
"Dear guardian," said I,
"as I have shut her out so long, though indeed, indeed, she is like the light to me—"
"I know it well, Dame Durden, well."
He was so good. His touch expressed such endearing compassion and affection, and the tone of his voice carried such comfort into my heart that I stopped for a little while, quite unable to go on.
"Yes, yes, you are tired," said he. "Rest a little. You are tired," said he. "Rest a little."
"As I have kept Ada out so long," I began afresh after a short while, "I think I should like to have my own way a little longer, Guardian. It would be best to be away from here before I see her. If Charlie and I were to go to some country lodging as soon as I can move, and if I had a week there in which to grow stronger, and to be revived by the sweet air, and to look forward to the happiness of having Ada with me again, I think it would be better for us." I hope it was not a poor thing in me to wish to be a little more used to my altered self before I met the eyes of the dear girl I longed so ardently to see. But it is the truth. I did. He understood me, I was sure, but I was not afraid of that. If it were a poor thing, I knew he would pass it over.
"A spoilt little woman," said my guardian, "shall have her own way even in her inflexibility, though at the price, I know, of tears downstairs. And see here. Here is Boythorn, heart of chivalry, breathing such ferocious vows as never were breathed on paper before, that if you don't go and occupy his whole house, he having already turned out of it expressly for that purpose, by heaven and by earth he'll pull it down, and not leave one brick standing on another."
And my guardian put a letter in my hand, without any ordinary beginning, such as, "My dear Jarndyce," but rushing at once into the words, "I swear if Miss Summerson do not come down and take possession of my house, which I vacate for her this day at 1 o'clock p.m., and then with the utmost seriousness, and in the most emphatic terms, going on to make the extraordinary declaration he had quoted. We did not appreciate the writer less for laughing heartily over it, and we settled that I should send him a letter of thanks on the morrow, and accept his offer. It was a most agreeable one to me, for all the places I could have thought of, I should have liked to go to none so well as Chesney Wold.
"Now, little housewife," said my guardian, looking at his watch, "I was strictly timed before I came upstairs, for you must not be tired too soon, and my time has waned away to the last minute. I have one other petition. Little Miss Flight, hearing a rumour that you were ill, made nothing of walking down here, 20 miles, poor soul, in a pair of dancing shoes, to inquire. It was heaven's mercy we were at home, or she would have walked back again."
The old conspiracy to make me happy. Everybody seemed to be in it.
"Now, pet," said my guardian, "if it would not be irksome to you to admit the harmless little creature one afternoon before you save Boythorn's otherwise devoted house from demolition, I believe you would make her prouder and better pleased with herself than I, though my eminent name is Jarndyce, could do in a lifetime."
I have no doubt he knew there would be something in the simple image of the poor afflicted creature that would fall like a gentle lesson on my mind at that time. I felt it as he spoke to me. I could not tell him heartily enough how ready I was to receive her. I had always pitied her, never so much as now. I had always been glad of my little power to soothe her under her calamity, but never, never half so glad before. We arranged a time for Miss Flight to come out by the coach and share my early dinner. When my guardian left me, I turned my face away upon my couch and prayed to be forgiven if I, surrounded by such blessings, had magnified to myself the little trial that I had to undergo. The childish prayer of that old birthday, when I had aspired to be industrious, contented, and true-hearted, and to do good to some one, and win some love to myself, if I could, came back into my mind with a reproachful sense of all the happiness I had since enjoyed, and all the affectionate hearts that had been turned towards me. If I were weak now, what had I profited by those mercies? I repeated the old childish prayer in its old childish words, and found that its old peace had not departed from it. My guardian now came every day. In a week or so more, I could walk about our rooms and hold long talks with Ada from behind the window curtain. Yet I never saw her, for I had not as yet the courage to look at her dear face, though I could have done so easily without her seeing me. On the appointed day, Miss Flight arrived. The poor little creature ran into my room quite forgetful of her usual dignity, and crying from her very heart of hearts, "My dear Fitz Jarndyce," fell upon my neck and kissed me 20 times.
"Dear me," said she, putting her hand into her reticule, "I have nothing here but documents. My dear Fitz Jarndyce, I must borrow a pocket handkerchief."
Charlie gave her one, and the good creature certainly made use of it, for she held it to her eyes with both hands and sat so, shedding tears for the next 10 minutes.
"With pleasure, my dear Fitz Jarndyce," she was careful to explain. "Not the least pain. Pleasure to see you well again. Pleasure at having the honour of being admitted to see you. I'm so much fonder of you, my love, than of the Chancellor, though I do attend court regularly. By the by, my dear, mentioning pocket-handkerchiefs—"
Miss Flight here looked at Charlie, who had been to meet her at the place where the coach stopped. Charlie glanced at me and looked unwilling to pursue the suggestion.
"Very right," said Miss Flight. "Very correct. Truly, highly indiscreet of me to mention it. But, my dear Miss Fitz Jarndyce, I'm afraid I am at times— "Between ourselves, you wouldn't think it—a little rambling, you know," said Miss Flight,
touching her forehead. Nothing more.
What were you going to tell me? Said I, smiling, for I saw she wanted to go on. You have roused my curiosity, and now you must gratify it.
Miss Flight looked at Charlie for advice in this important crisis, who said,
If you please, ma'am, you had better tell then.
And therein gratified Miss Flight beyond measure.
So sagacious, our young friend, said she to me in her mysterious way. Diminutive, but very sagacious. Well, my dear, it's a pretty anecdote, nothing more. Still, I think it charming. Who should follow us down the road from the coach, my dear, but a poor person in a very ungenteel bonnet?
Jenny, if you please, miss, said Charlie.
Just so, Miss Flight acquiesced with the greatest suavity. Jenny, yes. And what does she tell our young friend but that there has been a lady with a veil inquiring at her cottage after my dear Fitzjarndyce's health, and taking a handkerchief away with her as a little keepsake, merely because it was my amiable Fitzjarndyce's. Now, you know, so very prepossessing is the lady with the veil.
If you please, miss, said Charlie, to whom I looked in some astonishment, Jenny says that when her baby died you left a handkerchief there, and that she put it away and kept it with the baby's little things. I think, if you please, partly because it was yours, miss, and partly because it had covered the baby.
Diminutive, whispered Miss Flight, making a variety of motions about her own forehead to express intellect in Charlie. But exceedingly sagacious, and so clear. My love, she's clearer than any counsel I ever heard.
Yes, Charlie, I returned. I remember it.
Well?
Well, miss, said Charlie, and that's the handkerchief the lady took. And Jenny wants you to know that she wouldn't have made away with it herself for a heap of money, but that the lady took it and left some money instead. Jenny don't know her at all, if you please, miss.
Why, who can she be? Said I. My love, Miss Flight suggested, advancing her lips to my ear with her most mysterious look. In my opinion, don't mention this to our diminutive friend, she's the Lord Chancellor's wife. He's married, you know. And I understand she leads him a terrible life. Throws his lordship's papers into the fire, my dear, if he won't pay the jeweller.
I did not think very much about this lady then, for I had an impression that it might be Caddy. Besides, my attention was diverted by my visitor, who was cold after her ride, and looked hungry, and who, our dinner being brought in, required some little assistance in arraying herself with great satisfaction in a pitiable old scarf and a much-worn and often mended pair of gloves, which she had brought down in a paper parcel. I had to preside, too, over the entertainment, consisting of a dish of fish, a roast fowl, a sweetbread, vegetables, pudding, and Madeira, and it was so pleasant to see how she enjoyed it, and with what state and ceremony she did honour to it, that I was soon thinking of nothing else. When we had finished and had our little dessert before us, embellished by the hands of my dear, who would yield the superintendence of everything prepared for me to no one, Miss Flight was so very chatty and happy that I thought I would lead her to her own history, as she was always pleased to talk about herself. I began by saying, "You have attended on the Lord Chancellor many years, Miss Flight?"
"Oh, many, many, many years, my dear, but I expect a judgment shortly."
There was an anxiety, even in her hopefulness, that made me doubtful if I had done right in approaching the subject. I thought I would say no more about it.
"My father expected a judgment," said Miss Flight. "My brother, my sister, they all expected a judgment, the same that I expect."
"They are all..."
"Yes. Dead, of course, my dear," said she.
As I saw she would go on, I thought it best to try to be serviceable to her by meeting the theme rather than avoiding it.
"Would it not be wiser," said I, "to expect this judgment no more?"
"Why, my dear," she answered promptly, "of course it would."
"And to attend the court no more?"
"Equally, of course," said she. "Very wearing to be always in expectation of what never comes, my dear Fitzjarndyce. Wearing, I assure you, to the bone."
She slightly showed me her arm, and it was fearfully thin indeed.
"But, my dear," she went on in her mysterious way, "there's a dreadful attraction in the place. Hush! Don't mention it to our diminutive friend when she comes in, or it may frighten her with good reason. There's a cruel attraction in the place. You can't leave it, and you must expect."
I tried to assure her that this was not so. She heard me patiently and smilingly, but was ready with her own answer.
"Aye, aye, aye. You think so because I am a little rambling. Very absurd to be a little rambling, is it not? Very confusing, too, to the head. I find it so. But, my dear, I've been there many years, and I have noticed. It's the mace and seal upon the table."
"What could they do, did you think?" I mildly asked her.
"Draw,"
returned Miss Flight. "Draw people on, my dear. Draw peace out of them, sense out of them, good looks out of them, good qualities out of them. I have felt them even drawing my rest away in the night, cold and glittering devils."
She tapped me several times upon the arm, and nodded good-humouredly, as if she were anxious I should understand that I had no cause to fear her, though she spoke so gloomily and confided these awful secrets to me.
"Let me see," said she. "I'll tell you my own case. Before they ever drew me, before I had ever seen them, what was it I used to do? Tambourine playing? No, tambour work. I and my sister worked at tambour work. Our father and our brother had a builder's business. We all lived together, very respectably, my dear. First our father was drawn, slowly. Home was drawn with him. In a few years,